Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Line her up. You only have to be very, very gentle. A bit more powerful than a punch, huh?
That's from the new bloody desert thriller from director Rose Glass, starring Kristen Stewart, Ed Harris, and the lesser-known Katie O'Brien.
We've got a review of Love Lies Bleeding, and our William Wyler marathon continues with the director's Best Picture winning The Best Years of Our Lives.
That and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Josh, last week marked the glorious return of Trivia Spotting. 90 Film Spotting family members joining us for some virtual pub-style movie trivia. Good times were had, despite knowing very few answers myself. And yet, I think if I heard our quizmaster, Thomas Todd, correctly at the end, my team, Cinema Toast Crunch, did just finish off the podium at fourth. You were on the podium. Your team took third.
Made it to the podium. How about that? No thanks to me. I can attest to that. As a matter of fact, I think I worked against our team. Molly Kossoff was a team member. One of the questions, she threw out an answer and didn't sound right to a handful of others. And I just, you know, being the team captain, I thought, let's go with consensus. Sure enough, we got that one wrong. I apologize to Molly then. I will apologize again because who knows? That might have launched us to second place, that one
good
question.
Point. Yeah, I think I've had Molly on my team before. I've been fortunate to have Molly on my team before. And what I remember, Josh, that maybe you don't recall is of the three of us, you, me, and Molly, she's the only one who's been on Jeopardy. So How about not picking against her?
See, you know, Molly should have led with that because I had forgotten it. And yes, definitely then I would have said her one vote vetoes the five others.
Right. A couple of ways that you can enjoy Trivia Spotting. You can listen to last week's game. We've posted it as a bonus episode in the special feeds available only to our family members. You can also join us for a future round of trivia. We see ourselves doing this about once a quarter, exclusively for family members. FilmSpottingFamily.com is where you can get more info. I think I truly knew three of the 20 questions. That's it.
I mean, I feel like Thomas came in a little hard.
A little hot.
It's like
he's aware.
He had all these great questions pent up or something because they were a tad more difficult than before. But that's just me speaking. Plenty of others had no problems, no issues. So
these guys haven't called me for Trivia Spotting in over a year. I'm really going to give it to them.
Exactly.
Later in the show, Film Spotting Madness, the best of the 1950s. Our Elite Eight matchups are set. Kubrick's out. Bergman's out. Two Hitchcocks are still in. Two Wilders are still in. And is Charles Laughton being fitted for a glass slipper as we speak? For more info or to vote, filmspotting.net/madness. Also later in the show, we get to talk about a film widely considered one of the greatest of all time. Certainly one of the greatest films of all time that I hadn't seen until this week and this marathon. So glad I did. I know what people are talking about now. It's William Wyler's Best Picture winning 1946 film, The Best Years of Our Lives. It is the second film in our Wyler marathon. More information about that is at filmspotting.net/marathons.
First up, Love Lies Bleeding from director Rose Glass.
So where did you appear from?
Oklahoma.
I've never been anywhere but here.
What were you doing with that big girl?
Get a lot of crazy ass foreigners mostly. How's it going, guys?
What makes for movie chemistry? It's a bit of a you-know-it-when-you-see-it proposition. I could try to break it down and offer some sort of analytical formula, or I could just show you George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez trapped in a car trunk together in Out of Sight. Unfortunately, this is Film Spotting, Adam, so it's our job to break it down. And I want to do that within the context of Love Lies Bleeding, a new crime drama from St. Maud director Rose Glass. Set in the American Southwest in the late 1980s, the movie stars Kristen Stewart as Lou, the scruffy manager of a scuzzy gym where she spends most of her time unclogging toilets and selling steroids on the side. It's a lonely life until the arrival of Jackie, played by Katie O'Brien, a statuesque female bodybuilder who is hitchhiking her way to a competition in Las Vegas. Immediately, sparks fly. Isn't that the cliche we usually use to suggest on-screen chemistry?
Yes.
But complications soon follow, not so much because these are two women, but because Lou's life includes two very problematic men: her abusive brother-in-law, played by Dave Franco, and her criminal father, played by Ed Harris. Back to that chemistry between Stewart and O'Brien. Maybe you'll surprise me, Adam, and tell me you didn't think there was much of a charge between the two actors. That would be its own interesting conversation. But assuming you did, tell me what it was about their dynamic that was so compelling, what that might have taught you about movie chemistry, and how all of this plays into Love Lies Bleeding as a whole.
Well, start with as a whole. We don't often in these reviews, despite sometimes talking about movies for 40 to 60 minutes, urge people to go see a movie, unless you're like my wife, who generally doesn't enjoy very violent movies. And I think Love Lies Bleeding, as its title would suggest, qualifies. I'm going to say this movie deserves your attention, especially seeing it on the big screen, where you can fully appreciate Glass's rhetorical choices. With St. Maud and Love Lies Bleeding, she has established herself as a daring visual storyteller.
Big swings.
Including her big use of color, her bold use of color, brash compositions, among other adventurous decisions she makes, which I'm sure we'll get into. And I think maybe we can get into without divulging spoilers. We'll see. To answer your question, though, on Film Spotting 1567, when we're doing our top five most feral performers, Kristen Stewart will probably still be my number one. She has always been that. Here's a cool shove scenario I'll give you to illustrate what I mean. I'm convinced that you could cut between a close-up of Kristen Stewart's face and a cardboard box, and any viewer would be sure that it's the most attractive, most enticing cardboard box ever created. And she's not just going to possess it. She's somehow going to consume it completely. She's going to devour it. She just so naturally and forcefully exhibits something beyond yearning. It's hunger.
Yeah.
Now replace that cardboard box with a very talented actress in her own right, in Katie O'Brien, who I'm seeing for the first time here, playing a charismatic, confident, commanding physical presence in Jackie, who doesn't just like her back, but kind of wants to be devoured. Then you've got something combustible. I'm going to call this chemistry combustible, Josh. It very much worked for me.
And we are so in line with this because you've chosen two words that I used when I wrote about
which
ones? Love Lies Bleeding. I said the two fall into a feral affair. That feral is absolutely what you want to use to describe this. And then also, yeah, I was thinking about this chemistry question. And I knew chemistry was not the right word. And so I said, they don't have chemistry, they have combustibility. And I think it is this sense of danger. And this doesn't mean every successful example of on-screen chemistry needs this. But for these two characters in particular, and maybe these two performers, for me at least, what was riveting was that you're never, despite that desire they have for each other, and how it's individualized. You're right to describe the hunger being very much on the part of Stewart. And then while O'Brien is, you know, returning that in some ways, there's a little bit of almost a softness to her, even though she's the larger one physically, right, and the stronger one clearly. There's something about her
naivete.
Eyes. Maybe that's it too. Yeah.
Stewart's character is more knowing.
Exactly. She is, you know, this is another thing we can get into that's separate from the chemistry, but if you want to talk about this as a neo-noir, which it very much is how we're playing with the femme fatale characters here and the dupe, if there is one, and how they both inhabit certain aspects of those stereotypes. Yes. in the noir genre. But as far as the chemistry goes, yeah, they're riveting because you're never quite certain which one is more dangerous to the other. Even yeah. though in a sense you're rooting for them because they are both living very lonely, difficult lives. And when they find human connection, you want to root for them. You're still not entirely sure. Not that either of them is playing a con, although maybe you could, you know, squint and wonder if Jackie might be playing some sort of long con. That's certainly, it was in my mind for a long time in this movie. You're just never quite sure who's going to come out the worse for wear at the other side of this relationship. Even as in the moment, they're both exactly where they want to be. And I think it's that dangerousness that does make this unique. And the one thing I learned about chemistry from this, I think, is, again, it's less analytical than just what you feel when you're watching it. I feel like I know if actors have chemistry, if it seems like we're invading their privacy. Mm-hmm. The more I feel like I'm invading this moment and I shouldn't be a part of this, then I think there's more chemistry between those two performers. When the intimacy is that's
the word.
Palpable. When yes. it's so palpable, and it is throughout this movie, and for me, it's one of the key things that, you know, maybe elevates it beyond the violence you're talking about. The mm-hmm. There's a mean streak in this movie that might not sit well for some viewers, but I think because of this chemistry and connection and intimacy they have, really this registered for me as a nightmare metaphor for how hard some people have to fight for love. And that's especially the case when it's a love that's not approved of. And that's mm-hmm. sort of where I landed, where I came out of this movie feeling like it had kind of hit something that was really meaningful in a way, in an emotional way, for a movie that is otherwise pretty harsh, pretty violent, awfully mean. And as we've said, I think at least once, scuzzy as well.
Yeah, no, I really like that choice of word, Josh, and I like the choice of intimacy. We're using each other's favorite words tonight because that's really what you get with this relationship. That's really what makes it so complex and fascinating. You're absolutely right. You don't really know. As much as you're rooting for them, you also know how terrible it is for both of them to be together, for them to be with each other. And so there's this tension in many ways, in lots of different ways, that runs throughout this entire film. And even just in terms of describing them, take it separately from their relationship, just describing them as people. This is what good noirs do, right? Is the moment you catch yourself trying to explain why either of them are actually fundamentally good, or I really empathize with her, she's clearly trying to do this or make a change for this, break away from her family, you then start cataloging in your head all the things you see her do. Like if you were explaining to a judge, she's right. a great person,
right?
but she did these 27 things. It would be pretty hard uh-huh. to make that case, right? I was trying to come up with the right comparison here, and I'm not totally sure I landed it. But watching this movie, I felt like I was watching a movie we both love, Paris, Texas, if it was directed by Pasolini. Like it might look something like Love Lies Bleeding. Take those exterior shots, those nighttime shots of everything, but of the gym in particular, with the neon colors.
Yeah, yeah. There's that gas station shot in Paris, Texas.
Oh, the gas station shot.
It looks right. very much like this. You're right.
Took me right back. And it's beautiful, but also uninviting. There's something unhealthy, something lurid about the greens and yellows that we get here. And then in those flashback sequences, that slow motion and the red, the demon red that we get, and that choice of word I think is very appropriate here. I don't think Glass is trying to hide anything with that connection to the Ed Harris character who plays her father. But I want to get into the gore aspect of this a little bit and thinking about it in terms of her previous film, Saint Maud, mm-hmm. a film we both very much liked and put up for our Golden Brick the year it came out. I could be barking up the wrong tree, but I wonder if Silence of the Lambs was an influence on Glass at all. She was born only a year after it came out, so she would have had to come to that film quite later in life. But I think about characters like Jackie and Maude, and real quick, that makes me think, saying the name Jackie, I want to go back and just briefly say, you touched on fun it's having with noir and femme fatale conventions. I love the names of the characters, right? Lou, who's really Louise, as we hear at one point, but also I think another character calls her Lulu, which suggests this kind of malleable identity, this searching identity of hers. And then, of course, Jackie, who you could think of as Jack, or you'd find a character like her who's a man in a noir named Lou and Jackie. It's what you would expect, and yet this movie is having some fun with all of that. I think about Maude, I think about Jackie, and I'm going to get in here, Josh. This is where I don't think we're really getting into spoilers, because it's just part of the film. We could go deeper if we wanted, which we'll hold off on, but it's just part of the film proper. I think about the little physical moments that we get with Jackie's character at times, especially in times of duress. And really, what I think would qualify here as body horror.
Oh, yeah.
And I get that Hannibal Lecter line about Buffalo Bill running through my head, where he tells Clarice something like, he's not changing, he's evolving. That character is trying to force or compel a metaphysical transformation through physical means. And in Glass's films, it's reversed, maybe. There's a physical manifestation of the metaphysical transformation that's occurring. Even as I want to acknowledge, there's a significant fantasy element to both Saint Maude and this film. And those lines between what's fantasy and what's happening inside a character's own imagination and what's really happening, we could spend hours trying to break down. But the point is, the body horror isn't just about a filmmaker being adventurous with her choices or pushing buttons or pushing boundaries. It really is a representation of how these women in this film and Saint Maude see themselves, and potentially how others may ultimately see them. It's an exalted state. These women are experiencing a sort of rapture. It's painful, but it's a sort of rapture. Only one of them is explicitly religious, but I think the connections, certainly visually, the connections are still there.
Yeah, it ties to the chemistry too, because this is a very physical reaction they both have to each other. And so to make that then this bodily movie makes sense. And so we get those close-ups of Jackie's muscles, and we get, you know, this is, I think we can say this much about it because it happens in the, you know, the first third of the film, but Lou gives her some steroids. And once she begins taking them, there are moments of stress, anger, where we'll get an insert shot and we get, it's a Hulk shot. It's essentially a Hulk shot. Like her muscles will instantaneously grow, you know, in an unnatural way. And what's interesting in relation to Saint Maude is it's been a while since I've seen it, but I feel like there was a cleaner line there between what was happening in the main characters, the title character's head, the way she was experiencing the world, and what was actually happening in the quote unquote real world. And I think here in Love Lies Bleeding, those lines are blurred a little bit more, which, you know, will some viewers may appreciate, some may not, in comparison to Saint Maude. But I do think we go back and forth. For example, are Jackie's muscles really getting that big? Or is it more that that's how she feels? So it's this representation.
Yeah.
The insert shots suggest that. But then we will get, you know, as the movie moves further on, you could say like that's Jackie looking down at her arm. And that's why that's the perspective, right? But we'll get a full body shot of Jackie that's clearly now our perspective of her. She's not looking at herself, and she hulks out again. And so this is where the blurriness comes in. And it does make this fascinating.
I get it. I get it, though. I will say, in terms of that blurriness, even though I'm suggesting it's happening in her head and not really occurring, I don't think we have to see her looking at her arm to still feel that. You're right that the director is blurring it and that Glass isn't tying it explicitly to her point of view. But I think the suggestion, because that's pretty consistent throughout the whole film, I think the suggestion is, though, that is what, it's another way she is challenging us a little bit as viewers, because we're only seeing it from our point of view. But it's still, the idea is that it's a character undergoing the type of evolution that they want to be experiencing in that moment.
Well, and the other possibility is, or is this how Lou wants to see her? Is this
well,
how,
I think it's
right,
and that's what I love
Lou
about the chemistry.
Actually,
it goes back to your point about chemistry.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that fantasy element?
Yes.
Is something they both want to experience and feel that they need from Jackie needs it from herself and Lou needs it from Jackie.
So based on what you're saying, just real quick, a yes or no. We don't have to get into spoilers, but I'm going to take it. The big swing at the very end of this movie worked for you then.
Oh, man. Like gangbusters.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, I mean, it did for me as well. So just wanted to get to that. Your note about that that demon red, you called it. I love how there's even a moment, there's a hospital scene, and Lou encounters her dad there, played by Ed Harris, in the hallway, and they have a conversation in front of a Coke machine.
Yes.
And how glass just shoots this so that the light emanating from that Coke machine mm-hmm. is exactly the same shade as the red that we've seen in other sequences, and it's just throbbing. It's so accentuated. And yeah, so many shots in this movie work that way, where you begin to feel like there is no reality, like that no longer
right.
is there a real world and an imagined world or a metaphysical world or all these other things we're talking about. The real world has been left way behind at a certain point, it feels like.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And that's such a great point about the Coke machine. And as I recall it, isn't it a case where she's having some trouble with the machine and he has to help her?
Yeah, I think so. Something like that. Yeah.
It makes sense that he's completely in his space. He's in his natural view.
Yeah.
that red color is something that he's drawn to and can help her out with. I hope, too, it's coming across a little bit. I mean, did you find this movie, and this would be appropriate for the type of B-movie feel it's occasionally going for, though it's impeccably shot,
mm-hmm.
is it's pretty hilarious. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of bloody, gory films, I think it's pretty funny. You'll look away in disgust and involuntarily laugh at the fate of a certain character. And when you see it, if you haven't, you'll know precisely the part I mean. I'm thinking about even Ed Harris's hair choice. I'm thinking of Ed Harris's snack choice. And I will not give away the ending, but the closing image of the film I thought was laugh out loud funny.
Yeah.
And it also tells you everything you need to know about what the future holds for the people we see in that closing shot, even as something terrible is occurring in the background or has just occurred. This is the line this movie straddles. It also very clearly, with its framing choice, also wants to make you giggle a little bit. And I'm okay.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does. It's surely intentional. The moment Ed Harris shows up on screen looking like he's like a Sasquatch who had a bad run-in with a ceiling fan, you know that this movie wants you to laugh at times. And then we're kind of in, you know, sort of Tarantino territory from that point out. Like, at what point is the comic violence going to work for you? The ending is so impeccably framed and timed and staged. And I don't know if it necessarily is deep focus. We're going to get to that when we talk about the best years of our lives. But it definitely feels like it, at least, where one character is in the foreground and we're watching their face. But what's crucial is what's happening way in the background, right?
Yes.
So it's really well done. I have to say, part of it also connected to that mean streak I talked about. It involves a character who I think gets, you know, if not a raw deal, is very much used as the violent butt of the joke.
Sure.
And so, yeah, mileage is going to vary how much you laugh at those moments, but there's definitely a comedic streak going on here as well.
Well, I will first say that, of course, having seen the film, I know exactly what you're referring to, and I'll dance around it and simply say that I was mostly just horrified by that moment and not laughing, but I still think that in terms of this meanness that you're talking about, it's consistent with the entire film. And that character's duality is also completely consistent with all the other characters in the film. I really love, immediately I was looking up at the end of this film who the actress playing Jackie was, and I was also looking up who the actress who plays Daisy. It's Mikhail Baryshnikov's daughter, Anna Baryshnikov. I want to see any movie that she's doing next. I think all of her scenes with Kristen Stewart's character are really wonderful. And I like the character so much because the camera really showcases her well watching. And you take that character for granted the same way Kristen Stewart's Lou takes her for granted. But you come to realize, just as Lou does, along with Lou, that unfortunately she's been paying very close attention. And these things aren't sliding by her. And they're all going to come back into play. So watching her in that key scene that she has with Stewart at the diner.
Yeah.
Where she's playing at least two sides, maybe three or four.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great scene.
I loved it. And I really can't wait to see Love Lies Bleeding. Again, it is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Coming up, William Wyler's The Best Years of Our Lives, plus 50s Madness Elite Eight matchups. But first, a couple of very easy ways you can help the show, whether you're a longtime listener or just finding us. Take a minute and give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Really easy to do. Go ahead, do it right now while you're listening. Every new rating or review helps an independently produced show like ours reach new listeners. There's another way you can support us. You can also join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. We want to welcome new family member, Kristen, in Pittsburgh. Kristen wrote in, "I'd listened periodically before, but episode 769, the 1930 starter pack, is when I became a loyal listener. I watched Of Human Bondage after your talk about Betty Davis in the film. We usually ask our new family members if they have a favorite review or maybe a top five, and Kristen chose our top five LGBTQ films. Being someone who is part of the LGBTQ community, she says, I truly appreciated the top five, and it brought some blind spots to light for me."
That was episode 923 from last June. If you missed it and want to check it out, which of course you can if you're a Film Spotting family member, Kristen's Letterboxd top four or five. I like this list. The Departed, Anchorman, Whiplash, and The Artist. And I like seeing The Artist there, Josh. I don't know how you feel about it. It was before you joined the show. I know it's super fashionable and easy now to tear that film down, and it never should have won Best Picture. I gave it a pretty positive review. I gave it an extremely glowing review.
Yeah,
that year.
I'm with Kristen on this one. Really liked The Artist.
All right. Fifth here, if we're going to cheat a little bit, I love that Kristen includes a movie called Hesher. Have you heard of this movie, much less seen it, Josh?
I have not, despite the fact that it has Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Natalie Portman in it, apparently.
Yeah, I saw it. I want to say it came out 2007 or 8 because I saw it at Sundance that year. But otherwise, not discussed on the show, and a movie I'm guessing is a major blind spot for folks. The last movie Kristen saw in a theater, Godzilla Minus One, I'm So Jealous, Minus Color. Josh, how about this? A random film or filmmaker she loves, Wes Anderson.
There you go.
Love to see how he has developed as a director from Bottle Rocket to Asteroid City, and a movie she credits with being a cinephile. Growing up, my mom introduced me to Indiana Jones and the Star Wars original trilogy. Hell yeah, mom.
What a great mom.
Thank you, Kristen. And welcome to the family. In addition to keeping us doing what we're doing, your support does come with perks. You get to listen early and ad-free. You get the weekly newsletter. You get those monthly bonus shows. You get to participate in activities like trivia spotting. You do get to access every single episode in the archive. FilmSpottingFamily.com.
Sorry, we're closed.
Well, then what are all these people doing here?
Drinking and having a good time.
Well, that's why we're here.
You're too stupid to have a good time.
There's your warning, Josh. If you can't enjoy 1989's Roadhouse, you are, to quote Patrick Swayze's Dalton, too stupid to have a good time.
Sounds kind of mean.
It does, doesn't it? Next week, we'll have a blind cow review of the one and only Roadhouse, a blind cow being a case where one of us has not seen the movie, blind spotting. The other one is alleging that it's a sacred cow.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That would be usually, me.
Usually it's a different tier of film that gets the blind cow, but you know.
We're using the cow terminology a little liberally here, but we're gonna do a blind cow review of the one and only Roadhouse, which along with Patrick Swayze is the bouncer with a philosophy degree from NYU, also features Sam Elliott as Swayze's best friend and bouncer sensei, Ben Gazzara as the baddie, and the Jeff Healey Band as the house band at the Double Deuce. Come on, Josh, give me a few bars of Angel Eyes.
Wow. Every element of that description, I just kept getting more and more excited.
I hope so, because I can give you a quick anecdote that will explain just how excited I am. I probably should save it for next week, but I've been in a fantasy football league with some old coworkers for over 20 years now.
Whoa.
The town that Roadhouse takes place in, at least the original from 89, is Jasper, Missouri. I'm from Jasper County, Iowa, and there's two of us. I think we're the only co-managers, co-owners of a fantasy team in the league. So you want to know what our fantasy football team name is?
I'm dying to know.
The Jasper Double Deuces.
Wow.
And Patrick Swayze doing a karate chop or some karate move is our logo.
Amazing. And you've held on to that name for 20 years?
20 plus years.
You're like, this is so never gold. We're never changing it.
No, even though we really should, because I don't think we've ever won a championship. But enough about that. Why are we doing this? Well, I guess we couldn't find anything better to talk about. First and foremost, yes, Josh has been deprived of experiencing the film. I watched incessantly back in 89. Second, maybe not quite a sacred cow, but it does have a place in Scott Tobias's new cult canon. Does that help,
okay,
Josh?
Yeah. Yep. Getting even more intrigued.
Like Scott in 2008, Smart Critic, he wrote, "Let us stand in awe of Roadhouse, a supremely vulgar, winningly goofy entertainment that, to my mind, sets Swayze apart from his action movie peers." I don't know if winningly goofy entertainment is quite your cup of tea, Josh.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that sounds insulting to the greatness of Roadhouse. That well, Scott was kind of underplaying it there.
It's a backhanded compliment, yeah, really. Clearly, and that's fine. I get it. Okay, other reasons. Yes, a remake starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Dalton just arrived on Prime Video. And surprise, surprise, that completely unnecessary, but welcome, at least to me, remake is supposed to be pretty good, at least according to our friend Matt Singer. And I'm not going to look at anybody else's comments. He says, this is the kind of consistently entertaining movie you could happily watch 100 times without ever actively intending to watch it twice again. Backhanded, but a compliment.
And apparently how you spent 1989.
It is exactly. What's really funny is before I looked at that line that Sam had put in our notes for us, I actually was going to say I watched it over 100 times back in 89. So I know exactly of what Matt speaks. So next week, The Double Deuce, Roadhouse 89 and Roadhouse 24. I think for listeners like new family member Kristen, who was all into the 1930s starter pack, This show might be a skip. We'll see.
Or maybe, who knows, Adam, like a year from now, we might get a letter from a new family member saying,
Favorite episode.
The one that hooked me. That's when I stepped up and said, it's time to join.
We could dream. The 89 Roadhouse is also on Max and VOD. Both are streaming on Prime Video. And next week, Film Spotting Madness Best of the 60s Final Four revealed. For more info or to vote in the current round, filmspotting.net/madness.
If you're looking for more Love Lies Bleeding talk, well, check out our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. They've got a new pairing and they're looking at Love Lies Bleeding alongside the Wachowskis' Bound. That one from 1996 makes perfect sense.
Yes, it does.
Looking forward to listening to that one myself. You can get The Next Picture Show every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is blasphemy. This is madness!
This is absolute madness.
This is madness.
Madness.
Madness, madness!
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
Thank you, Gerard Butler. Film Spotting Madness is our annual bracket-style tournament this year, best of the 1950s. The NCAA tournament, Josh, it's just getting underway. Mm-hmm. We're already at the Elite Eight.
Yep.
We're ahead of things. Hitchcock, Kurosawa, Wilder, a Cinderella making a little run. Lots of fun, or at least we think it's lots of fun. Elite Eight voting is live. It closes, though, Monday, March 25th. You have until noon Central Time on Monday, March 25th to get your picks in. First up, our Sweet 16 results. A pair of upsets, technically, because they had a lower seed advancing. Neither one a huge surprise to the selection committee or probably anyone else. We do have the 1-5 seeds still in the dance. Also, number 8, number 11, and the number 23 seed, but it's not really the 23 seed that we'd call the Cinderella of this tourney. More on that in a second. That 23 seed, by the way, your nemesis, Josh. Mm. Sidney Lumet's beloved courtroom drama, 12 Angry Men. It took down Kubrick's Paths of Glory. It was close, 53-47%.
This one worries me. This one really worries me. I'm thinking 12 Angry Men is going to go way further than anyone imagined, but we'll see. Aaron Teachman had a comment about this. 12 Angry Men is a worthy social problem film that is competently made, but Paths of Glory demands your attention and your conscience with an urgency that 12 Angry Men doesn't muster.
Sam Thompson, this one was easy for me, but I'm afraid of people's irrational love for 12 Angry Men. Paths of Glory is true cinema with one of the greatest endings of all time. 12 Angry Men was maybe prescient 70 years ago, but has lost its luster.
Here's Ethan Johnson. I know Paths of Glory is a better film, and I definitely would have voted against Angry Men in the last round, but I'm a theater guy. Dialogue is what brings me in like nothing else. And while I admit that 12 Angry Men has lost its luster in the intervening years, a diamond is still a diamond, no matter its environment.
So Sam, trying to balance things out a little bit, balance out those scales of justice with the negative comments about 12 Angry Men or the more positive comments about Paths of Glory, but it was Paths of Glory that lost. 12 Angry Men's moving on. So 53% of voters said, Sam, Aaron, we hear you. And we probably like Kubrick too, but we do prefer the Sidney Lumet courtroom drama. It advances. We'll see how far it goes and whether or not it will haunt Josh's dreams. If the 23 seed 12 Angry Men is not the Cinderella of this tournament, then who is? Well, it's the 11 seed Night of the Hunter. Took down Bergman, the 6 seeded, the 7th seal in the Sweet 16. A commanding win, Josh, 61% to 39%.
Yeah, I don't think either of us predicted that, let alone at that rate. We heard from Billy Ray Bruton, leave it to my choice to go all the way, Night of the Hunter, to take down Bergman's classic. I think people sleep on just how beloved Hunter has become over the years. Thanks to folks like Martin Scorsese singing its praises, more and more cinephiles have discovered and fallen in love with Charles Laughton's masterpiece. Even to this day, no film has captured the same sort of dreamlike menace as this film, and Mitchum gives the ultimate villain performance. I want to see Hunter go all the way. Can it defeat the Seven Samurai? If it can, I believe nothing can stop it.
Here is my trivia spotting teammate, the very movie literate Sean Means. Without the Seventh Seal, we wouldn't have Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. And who wants to live in a world like that? As I said, very movie literate Sean Means.
Strong logic there, Sean.
Sam and I, the selection committee, were talking about the Cinderella story of the Night of the Hunter, the 11 seed. In our first iteration of these seeds, we had it at number 10. We thought it had that much of a chance to advance, moved it back just slightly, obviously one spot. Can't really say we're surprised because we knew it was a film our audience loved, but then there've been other films I thought for sure our audience loved and knew that we loved and they would go on. And Josh, some of them haven't. We'll see what Charles Laughton's film can do. Along with Night of the Hunter and 12 Angry Men, the rest of the films rounding out the Elite Eight are Hitchcock's Vertigo and Rear Window, Billy Wilder's Pair, Sunset Boulevard and Some Like It Hot, Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, and Kellyanne Donnan's Singin' in the Rain. The films we had to say goodbye to, Josh, read this list off. It's crazy.
Truffaut's 400 Blows, Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, Kurosawa's Rashomon, Ozu's Tokyo Story. We should note, though, it won a respectable 33% of the vote against Vertigo. All About Eve is also gone, losing 44% to 56% against Some Like It Hot. And we are also saying goodbye to Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah. Boo-hoo. I don't feel bad. It beat out Rio Bravo. Even though I love Bridge on the River Kwai, I'm still mad at that film. Elite Eight, Josh. 4 matchups, so we don't need to do all the different categories, the upsets, the tough to pick, the tough to predict. Let's just run through them. I think you'll agree with me for the most part, if not across the board here. There are 2 matchups that would have to qualify as pretty easy for us to vote in. Rear Window versus Some Like It Hot. And Singin' in the Rain versus 12 Angry Men.
Agreed, though I will note the first one, Rear Window versus Some Like It Hot, is only easy because Rear Window is the greatest film of all time.
Right.
So yeah, that's
I knew that's what we're talking
what
your about
reasoning
here.
Was. Okay.
Right. And similarly, well, no, not similarly. I do really like 12 Angry Men, but it's Singin' in the Rain. It doesn't have a shot. I didn't hesitate for a second in picking Singin' in the Rain. I also didn't hesitate for a second in picking Rear Window. Okay. The next one was tougher for me, certainly than those two. And I'm guessing for you as well, Josh. Charles Laughton's Night of the Hunter. Here it is. Billy Ray said it. If it can take down Seven Samurai, then it might go on to win it all. But it is going to be very difficult to take down that formidable group of samurai. How are you voting in this one?
It just doesn't seem right to get to the final four with no Kurosawa. And it's strange enough that Bergman's gone. And now we're going to boot Kurosawa potentially. And yet, just looking at those two films alone.
I know.
Right?
I know.
And trying to put the Kurosawa aside, the body of work, shall I say, the stature as a cinematic master aside, and looking at the two films, I might have to go with Night of the Hunter. But this is why it's so unfair, because I'm only doing that because I think, well, but this Kurosawa is great too, and that one is great too, and that one's also great. Well, they're all gone. So that shouldn't matter, but somehow in my brain, I'm justifying it. I don't know. I think I'm leaning Night of the Hunter, though.
I am too. I know that's me being on brand, because it's now my thing to apparently dislike The Seven Samurai. I adore Kurosawa. And I agree with you that I can't believe this would mean Kurosawa's out of the tournament. But I'm with our audience. This is how strongly I feel about The Night of the Hunter. I love that film. And I'm just imagining not just my kids, but 100 random cinephiles who hadn't seen either film, and I had to pick only one. I know how important a film The Seven Samurai is, but I'd say you got to see The Night of the Hunter.
Is this part of it too? That I don't know that there is another film like Night of the Hunter. And I do know there are other historical action samurai epics. You could argue Seven Samurai is the best one. And so then you lose that logic. But it is in some ways a genre film. And there are other excellent examples of that genre. What do you call Night of the Hunter? I mean, it's been tried to be pigeonholed in different genres, but I don't think you can really do that. And not only is it a genre question, it's a visual question. What other movie looks like that one in so many of those shots? So I think for me, that's part of my thinking as well.
Yeah, I think that is a great point. And I just want the world to know, and I'll move on quickly here, that Josh is saying, just watch The Magnificent Seven. You'll be fine.
Well,
maybe even the remake. Just watch The Magnificent Seven remake.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Okay, then is this one the toughest one for you or not? Because it was the toughest one for me. It sounds like Night of the Hunter versus Seven Samurai was the hardest for you. Right at this moment, I still don't know which film I'm picking here. It's another Alfred Hitchcock film, Vertigo, up against Billy Wilder and Sunset Boulevard. Of the two Wilder films that's in this tournament, I have Sunset Boulevard ranked way higher than Some Like It Hot. And it's my second favorite. I think I have it as my second favorite Wilder film after Double Indemnity. We could use the logic that Hitchcock's already got one that's advancing and doing quite well. And we'll probably, I haven't looked at the results at this point in the voting, but probably will beat Wilder in that other matchup. Do I want to vote for Wilder here? I think I do, Josh. I think I do. I think just in terms of kind of the same application, which movie do I want to put in and rewatch again right this moment? Which one do I want to make sure is still around so I could show my kids? Of course, I feel that way about Vertigo, but if I have to choose, I'm going to go Sunset Boulevard, I think.
Yeah, and for me, it's the logic, which I use throughout the tournament, of there's another film by that filmmaker still available.
Your cop-out, you mean?
Yeah, pretty much. And it's a film I like better. I feel strongly about that, having just done that revisitation of both titles. And I would similarly feel bad not to have any more Wilder after this point. So,
sure.
Sunset Boulevard for me as well.
Okay. Let's talk about the bracket contest. We have over 550 predictions submitted. After the Sweet 16, we're down to just one leader.
Hey.
It's Ricky Kendall in the UK. We heard from Ricky. Sam, our producer, reached out, got a little bit of background on Ricky here, Josh.
To say your email was a surprise would be a huge understatement. I had to double check the bracket to make sure. You see, to totally misquote Shakespeare, though this be madness, there is absolutely no method in it. It's a total fluke. I just went on gut instinct with zero research, planning, or forethought. Oh, no.
The Larson
Ricky,
method.
Don't tell Adam and Sam that. But as the bracket doesn't lie, a bit about me. My name is Ricky, and I am a teacher from the UK. I've been listening to Film Spotting since 2017 after coming across a video Josh did with the British critic Mark Kermode. The range and breadth of movies from around the world that are intelligently discussed in the different sections of Film Spotting make it stimulating and refreshing an idea. Podcast. Hearing you guys attempt British accents on Massacre Theater is a particular joy.
Okay, I'm glad it's bring joy to someone.
We try, Ricky. My favorite film is It's a Wonderful Life. Ricky says, I've seen it over 100 times and it never fails to revive my faith that humanity can rise to greater heights no matter how bleak things may look. My prediction bracket title, So Again We Are Defeated, is a translated quote from Seven Samurai, the film I credit with opening my eyes to a world of cinema beyond the Anglophone sphere. I also love that Adam passionately defends The Exorcist in the face of Josh's skepticism. That being said, I have both of Josh's books and heartily recommend them to all. Keep up the excellent work. Well, thank you for that, Ricky.
Yeah, thank you indeed. And mentioning books and The Exorcist and Mark Kermode, Kermode literally wrote the book on The Exorcist, the BFI version of that. Last week's leaders, Damon Minor, Monica Silva in London, and Adam Krosh in LA, all slipped a little. Damon and Adam, they took the Kempinar fall. They're down to 78th from Yikes. Tied for first. They missed three in the Sweet 16. Monica is hanging in there. Fourth place, only missed one. She's just behind. Come on. In second place, Madness Godfather Mike Merrigan. He won it all last year, and he's back at it. I just don't know what it is.
Have we launched an investigation yet? I mean, it's high time.
I guess somebody's in some ways look into it's this. Fitting, but it makes me mad, Mike. And you're a nice guy, and I don't want you to make me mad. Our internal bracket contest is Mike, as the Madness Godfather, but also as last year's winner, going up against me. You and our producer, Sam, we like to see not so much who comes out on top, though, who really comes in last and has to serve some kind of movie related punishment.
Who's going
to
be watching Mike Spaceman? Let's just say it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is the latest from Sandler on Netflix. Mike is obviously in the lead and almost surely not going to be caught. He only missed two picks so far through three rounds. It was Imitation of Life beating Sleeping Beauty in round one. And then he did have the Searchers advancing to the Sweet 16. I only missed one this round, and it was Choosing the Seventh Seal over Night of the Hunter. That bumped me all the way up, Josh, from 202nd to 113th.
Not bad.
No. You moved up two from 341st to 193rd.
I'll take it. I will take it.
Yeah. You missed the same one. You picked Seventh Seal over Night of the Hunter. Our producer, Sam, still doing well. He's in 89th place. He also picked the Seventh Seal over the Night of the Hunter. Now, Sam has seen some things that I haven't seen yet. You both made some bold choices in this Elite Eight round that it seems may not work out well for you.
Could this be related to a group of men who are angry?
No.
Oh.
I'm not sure that it is actually related to them.
Okay. I'll have to check my bracket.
Though, you know, Hitch always seemed like kind of an angry man to me. Maybe he's the angry man that I'm talking about. We will see how things look next week. Elite Eight voting is open. Vote now at filmspotting.net or filmspotting.net/madness.
This is my street.
1517.
It's the fourth house from here. I wonder if Wilma's home. Say, how about the three of us going back to Butcher's place? We'll have a couple of drinks and then we can go home.
You're home now, kid.
Harold Russell, Frederick March, and Dana Andrews in that early scene from William Wyler's The Best Years of Our Lives. It's the second film in our sixth film, William Wyler Marathon. First up, a quick programming note. I don't know that anyone caught this besides film spotting archivist Bill McLaughlin in Kelowna, British Columbia, but he did point out, and he was right to point it out, that if you looked at our marathons page, Josh, we did have Mrs. Miniver next, ahead of The Best Years of Our Lives, because we do usually go in chronological order, but we had put off that Mrs. Miniver decision for a while, and when we did decide, I updated it on the marathons page, but not on the show schedule.
Aha.
That all of us reference. So Sam, you know, rightfully put in Best Years of Our Lives as the next movie up. And here we are jumping all the way ahead to 46.
I don't know. I'm losing faith in the spreadsheet system, Adam, if
yeah,
this is what happens.
Troubling, isn't it? We will get to Mrs. Miniver in a couple of weeks and Ben-Hur after that.
For now, let's talk about The Best Years of Our Lives, which came to theaters in December 1946, just over a year after the end of the Second World War in September 1945, following the atomic bombing of Japan and that country's surrender. The film opens with three soldiers trying to make their way back to their hometown of Boone City: Frederick March's Army Sergeant Al Stevenson, Dana Andrews' Air Force Captain Fred Derry, and Harold Russell's Petty Officer Homer Parrish. As the scene you heard suggests, their return after years abroad is filled with anxiety. March's Al, a middle-aged banker who volunteered for an unglamorous assignment in the Army, is reunited with his wife, played by Myrna Loy, and kids. They are grown-up Teresa Wright and high schooler Michael Hall. Andrews' Captain Derry escaped a life of poverty to become a high-ranking hero in the Air Force, only to return to a life with few career opportunities and a new wife he hardly knows, played by Virginia Mayo. And Russell's Homer Parrish, a former star athlete in high school, returns home to his loving family and fiancé as a double amputee. Russell was an actual war vet who lost both hands during military service.
The Best Years of Our Lives was nominated for 8 Oscars. It won 7, including Best Picture and Director for Wyler. Russell won both a Best Supporting Actor Award and an Honorary Award for bringing hope and courage to his fellow veterans. March won for Lead Actor and Robert E. Sherwood for Screenplay. There are a lot of places we could start with this movie, Josh. Where I want to begin is with a little insight that you get when doing a marathon like this, watching films mostly in order. Last week, we talked about Dodsworth, released 10 years before. It's a movie about a couple in transition, trying to figure out who they are to each other, now that husband Sam has sold his business and wife Fran can start to enjoy the carefree and luxurious life abroad that she's always pined for and always thought she deserved. Things don't go great. And things only go a little better for the three couples in transition that we get here in Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah. And in so many different ways, even though the essential root of their struggles, their challenges, are these now veterans returning home and trying to assimilate back to their previous lives. You know, I was looking at them. I had known, because I had seen this a number of years ago, that it had appeared on, you know, at least one top five list over the years that I put together. And so I was looking just in some old notes and stuff, and it came up in top five married couples, something like that, or marriage movies. And it wasn't a pick of mine. It was actually, I'm pretty sure it was longtime listener Peter Labuza who wrote in and suggested it. So I just called that out as an honorable mention. And it's very much for, you know, what you're talking about is we're getting this triptych portrait of marriage in the aftermath of war. And I think of that moment where Al and Millie are reunited, and this is very early on. The excitement, the hubbub has worn down a little bit from the kids greeting him, and this is a surprise to all three of them that he's shown up home. And they both look at each other. Things have quieted down, and they both ask each other, "Are you all right?"
Yeah.
And it's they know they're the oldest couple that we meet. And so I think we're going to talk about this. So many little asides or moments that hit you so hard in this movie, and they may not be the point of the scene. Like this is almost something that is said in passing. I think they're just coming to each other in the hallway. And like I said, it's been a moment to take a breath, and they look at each other, each ask each other, "Are you all right?" Acknowledging that this isn't going to be just an easy celebration. And I want to know what happened to you. I want to know what you've been through. Contrast that to what happens with the youngest married couple that we meet, Fred and Marie, where she complains somewhat about the nightmares he's having, but never really asks them what they're about. and never takes that next step to explore. And the movie doesn't paint her entirely as a villain. It's one of the things I liked about it. It's somewhat understandable for her to have that reaction, right? She wants to pick up right where they left off. She thinks he's going to come home and they'll just go back to their lives. And they were essentially, even though they had married, you know, still in the infatuation stage. So she doesn't want to think about that being stopped now that he's home. So those are just two examples of the way marriage is looked at differently and richly in this movie. And then when we get to Homer, who's engaged, you know, what we'll get into, I'm sure, how the dynamic plays out there, which is in a completely different, heartbreaking, yet deeply romantic and affirming, I feel like, register.
Yeah. And I think that couple, Wilma and Homer, are the youngest couple in terms of their actual ages. But as far as being a couple, they've known each other their entire lives.
That's
and
right.
And were together for a long time then, yeah, before he went off to war and came back. And they're contemplating marriage. And you're right, you've got Fred and Marie who are married, but know each other far less than Wilma and Homer. I'm going to give you, I thought I would bring this up later, but when you talk about these little touches where the scene isn't necessarily about that moment, but it's one of the indelible things you remember about the scene, and you can add up about 20 of these over the course of this film. There's a scene, and the scene itself is touching enough, but there's a scene that's going to come back into play later. It's going to be mirrored later. At this point, it's Homer going to bed, and we see what the process is, what the procedure is when he goes to bed. His father knows that every night he's going to come in and help his son get ready for bed. Getting ready for bed means that because Homer has now hooks for hands, he can do a lot of things, as we see later, but he can't do everything. He can't completely get changed into his pajamas and get into bed. And one of the things that the dad does that tells you so much about these characters as human beings in this routine, Homer's smoking a cigarette, like a lot of people in the movie do at various points. And he says something to him or kind of nudges him, kind of grunts like, you know, give me the cigarette kind of thing. And before his dad takes it, Homer takes one drag off it, one good long drag.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that happens so many times so far through these two Wyler films, but especially in The Best Years of Our Lives, where it would be so easy. And in so many other movies, we would see this. The character would be smoking because they're just smoking. It happens. It's habit. They're smokers. And it's time for the dad to take it and start the routine. The character gives it up. The dad takes it. What we get here is Homer taking one last drag because he knows that if he decides later, maybe that he wants to get a cigarette, it may not be that easy.
Yeah.
That this is just the way it is for him. And he's going to enjoy that moment before his dad takes it away. It's just such a beautiful moment that gives that character authenticity and humanity.
And that is the brilliance of Harold Russell's performance. Even though he's a non-professional, this is the list it did end up way back in 2014. This is why I watched Best Years of Our Lives. I remember I couldn't quite recall why I had just out of the blue watched this, but it was because I wanted to consider Russell's performance for top five performances by non-professionals. And, you know, he did lose his own hands in a training accident. He was featured in a military film about rehabilitation, and that's how he came to the attention of Hollywood. And what I talked about for that list is how, you know, there are line readings you could probably quibble with here where you see, especially in dialogue with professionals, right, that he is new to this. But it doesn't matter because what he does is embody this experience so thoroughly. It's in gestures exactly like what you talked about, Adam, knowing that that is something he probably lived through. How many times? Hundreds of times. And it may have not even been something he planned or was directed to do, but it's just how he knew to live in that moment. And I think that is a different type of acting that does need to be recognized. It's how he sits on the bed. And I love how Wyler leaves the camera in that scene with his father on the upper body so that we see Homer's face and we're not thinking about his hands at that moment. We're being forced to see him as the human he is.
That's right.
And yet the movie doesn't disregard or want us to ignore what he faces in real life.
The opposite. It wants us to reckon with it.
And here's the moment that I think these are like little grace notes we're talking about. And here is the one that just like I, you know, I've talked about this. I don't like cry at movies easily at all. As a matter of fact, if I see it coming, there's no way I'm going to. They have to sneak up on me. And I had somehow forgotten. It's been 10 years since I watched this the first time, the moment that did this. And so it happened again. This is very early on when the three of them have reunited the very same day that they come back. They've gone to their families and are so uncomfortable that they each find a way to get back to this bar, Butch's,
that's right,
that Homer has told them about, right? And how relieved are you as a viewer to see them get back there together?
I'm ecstatic.
You're so happy, right?
I mean, I'm so happy.
Not that you want them to flee their families, but you know, you can see they're itching in their skin. And and you know that they've immediately formed this camaraderie. So you're so happy to see them. Al has his wife and daughter with. They've been out going to clubs, and he wants to introduce them to Homer. And this is how he does it.
Oh, you got the Navy, the convoys, huh? First, we got to get one thing straight. Homer lost his hands. He's got those hooks instead. But they don't worry him, so they don't need to worry anybody else. Right, Homer?
Right.
Right. Now let's get seriously to work.
It's all there. It's like this is just it. It's not. It's very different from Homer's future father-in-law not letting Homer light his cigar in the scene. Whereas Al and Fred, the first time they meet, willingly allow Homer to light their cigarettes. They're going to acknowledge what he's been through, but they're not going to define him by it. And the way Al just says, this is how we're all going to handle this, just it makes me cry to see that sort of grace extended. And I think the beauty of this film is how we recognize the pain and the difficulty and the hardship that these men are going to face. And yet just when they and us are about to despair, we get a little grace note like that. That carries us through, and we hope and believe it's going to carry them through as well.
Yeah, I do want to go back a little bit because I just want to underscore some of the things you're saying about getting to know these three men, the power of this film, the moments that it captures, and the sophistication of Wyler's direction here. That opening, that first 20 minutes or whatever it is, where we get to know who these three men are. We get to spend time with them in a way that few movies really allow us to spend time with characters and really just get to understand their behavior and who they are. I'm thinking about another war movie or was in the moment that I'm guessing the best years of our lives was an influence on, and that's Michael Cimino's The Deer Hunter. You think about the opening of that film, right? And that town and those characters and all the time it spends before we even get to Vietnam, just hanging out with these guys. That flight that they take, not just a vehicle literally for them and for the plot, a vehicle for the plot to get them home. It becomes this extended encounter, this chance for them to bond with each other, to learn about who they are as men, to understand their anxieties. And those shots even are so glorious, Josh, of the city or the land as they're flying over the top. We're
the
not in a
plane
studio.
Of middle America is what we're seeing.
Yeah. We're going over middle America in what seems like all of its beauty, but we know already a little bit about the angst of these men, what they're coming from, what they might be facing, how they're feeling, and their fear about what they might be facing. And that line that one of them says, I didn't write down who exactly it is. It might've been Homer, but someone says playing golf just as if nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
This idea, right? That, yeah, great. We get a few echoes of this in the movie. We know that you suffered back at home too. You had to make sacrifices. Everyone did their part, whatever. You don't know what we went through, and you don't know what we're going through now when we come home. And yet life just continued to go on, and it continues to go on beneath them. As they're about to land, we return to this later in the film, but seeing the junkyard, the scrap heap of all those planes, the visual metaphor of that tying to these men, these once very capable, very powerful machines, now not needed, abandoned, right? Just like we fear they're going to be. And the other thing you realize early on, if you're paying attention to the dynamic and the uniforms they're wearing and the way they talk, you realize that what we've gotten here is men at three different stages of life in terms of age, experience, and as we noted, their coupledom or their marriages. Again, Homer is hopefully going to get married to Wilma, but not yet. But also, they're different ranks in the military. They're three different branches of military. We've got Army and Air Force and Navy. And then what we get upon landing is we put it all together and we realize that they're three different classes as well, right? With Fred, the lower class in this case, Homer, decidedly middle class, and Al, a banker, more upper class. It sounds maybe a bit too on the nose. There's nothing on the nose about this film.
It's really actually beautifully
effortless.
Handled.
It's effortless in the way that it's handled and in the way the movie doesn't draw too much attention to it. And then, like you said, Josh, by the time they're saying goodbye to each other, all I'm thinking about is how I pray they're going to reunite. And I'm not totally sure they would. This is the first time I've seen the movie. I don't know whether or not we're now going to get their three different stories and whether or not they're going to completely intersect. And how elated am I, to your point, when later that same day, it's not just later a couple weeks down the road, later in the same day they end up at Butch's bar. Even if for those characters, I wish the circumstances were a little less precarious, they're all three men in that moment who cannot be themselves at home.
Right.
They cannot be at home. And in Fred's case, he literally can't even get in to his home with Marie. It's one of the best, I want to call it one of the best opening scenes ever, but it's really just one of the best first 30 minutes or so of any movie I've ever seen.
And how about the cab ride specifically?
Oh, yeah.
In that's kind of like it does everything you're describing beautifully in miniature, and it doesn't feel repetitive at all because we feel the tension rising the closer each of them gets home. They share a cab home from the airport, and Homer's the first to get dropped off, and he is reluctant to go. And the other two.
And then Al is. And exactly. Fred is.
That's the thing. It's like the other two are. It's time. I think they say it's time to go home now. Right. But when it's time for them to go home, they are a little more jittery each themselves. And how about the shot of Fred looking out? I think Fred is the last to leave.
So
after Al gets dropped off, Fred looks out the back window of the taxi and an unbroken shot. There's no cut. The car pulls away and we just see Al through this tiny oval window getting further and further away. And it's that shot and the longing in that shot, the longing for camaraderie, which is why we're so thrilled when they get reunited in the bar.
Yeah. Well, and how about, Josh, the fact that Fred at this point, and I think throughout the film, we can still say as much time as it gives to all the storylines, he's the central character. And at the beginning, he is the first character we meet.
Yes.
We meet the other characters because of Fred. So how about that decision when they do stop at Homer's house? He's the first one to get out. We know he's nervous and the cab's about to take off. And Fred says, no, park it. And they stay. We get to watch that scene that we so desperately want to see. We want to know for Homer's sake what kind of welcome he gets. And we get to see it because Fred and Al stop to watch it because they desperately want to see how it plays out too. And the double power of that, where they care about Homer. They've already developed enough of a bond that they care about Homer and they want to see. But it just now occurs to me that, of course, they also probably are curious too.
Oh, sure.
Because right themselves. They don't know what's awaiting them. And so they want to see what kind of welcome Homer gets.
And it's a delay tactic. It's, you know, it's going to keep them maybe 5 minutes further from having to have that moment themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to get to the scene that, and there were multiple moments in this film, Josh, that made me, made me react, that it got a little dusty in the room. The one that did destroy me. And I'm guessing it's a more obvious choice than yours. I'm guessing it's one that has this impact on a lot of people. It's the scene that comes closer to the end between Homer and Wilma.
Oh,
in the bedroom. This is now the
incredible
the second time we've seen Homer go through this process, as I mentioned earlier, first with his father. And I did read this earlier today, Josh, that of course we take this for granted now. But back then, we don't totally take it for granted. Sometimes we talk about this. I even brought it up in the context of Dodsworth a little bit, that I thought it was pretty bold in its frankness about how it was handling some of the adultery and things going on for a movie that was governed by the production code at the time. A little racy as a movie could get in 36, I suppose. Well, here in 46, that scene between a couple, whether married or not, or maybe especially because they're not married, being in the same bedroom together, and the man is undressing, even if we never see him actually undressed, but we see him changing into his pajamas. That's too intimate for the production code. That never would have been allowed. And yet, because of the tenderness of that scene, I mean, I don't know what their thinking was or whether or not they did consider it, but it seems as though it was a scene that you would not get in any other film. And it stood in the best years of our lives because even the damn production code people couldn't overlook It's power. And the power of seeing Homer in that moment, finally, so reluctantly, but so thoroughly being vulnerable. And to go back to your point about how it's shot, similar here, focused on the upper body, camera motionless, still, Wyler letting the movements occur unadorned before us. All of a sudden, I felt like I was transported into a documentary. I was now watching a documentary, as if Wyler said, I'm going to give my audience a visual how-to guide for empathy. Not pitying, but empathizing, understanding. You're going to see, I'm going to make you watch what this is like, what this moment is like for a man in Homer's situation and other men like him. I can barely talk about it. Yeah. I want to move on. It's that heartbreaking.
This is when I know I'm helpless. My hands are down there on the bed. I can't put them on again without calling to somebody for help. I can't smoke a cigarette or read a book. If that door should blow shut, I can't open it and get out of this room. I'm as dependent as a baby that doesn't know how to get anything except cry for it. Well, now you know, Wilma. Now you have an idea of what it is.
It's the enacting of what Al said in the bar.
Yeah.
It's the recognizing, like, look, this is the situation. Homer, you know, knows the situation. He's dealing with it. And so we're going to follow his lead and do the same. And that is what Wilma does. Kathy O'Donnell's Wilma does. She is there for him how he needs her to be. And to your point about the code, this is not just romantic. I think it's downright sexy.
Yeah.
This is like if it made them feel uncomfortable and consider, you know, banning or not allowing it in, I wouldn't have been surprised, because it is the scenario. You know, she's kind of sneaking in, like his dad is supposed to be doing this, but instead she sees him in the kitchen from outside and she snuck in and he brings her upstairs. And yeah, this is not how things are supposed to go. But it's back to the intimacy. That's what makes it so sexy, is that you are seeing these two connect in a way you've been hoping for them. They have each individually been hoping for each other, but they've not found a way to get there yet. And now they're getting there. And how about the moment where her hands hesitate between like reaching out to assist him and holding back?
Yes.
And pausing. And then he lets her button his pajama shirt up.
And it's just real quick, Josh, it's one of those moments that you feel like absolutely could have been blocked in advance and planned, or was a completely authentic, natural reaction in the moment.
Sure.
Where we all do it when you see someone who needs help with something.
Yes.
Our reaction is at once to try to reach in and do it for them. And then we have to tell ourselves that's not our role. That's not our place. And we see that moment play out with her.
And this is, again, to the just the excellence of Russell's performance. This is all about how he's holding himself in that space and responding to her physically. There's very little dialogue at this point. And so all of those, you know, maybe moments where he might be a slightly stiff in the line reading, or you see that O'Donnell is clearly a pro, right? That falls away here. And instead, what you're watching, and this is, this is hard to talk about. Instead, what you're watching is something for the first time that you hope in your deepest heart is going to happen for the two of them for the rest of their lives.
You hope. You hope. And the movie maybe gives us enough of that sense of hope, even as with at least one of the other relationships, we don't necessarily get that. And I do just want to go back briefly. You're talking about Russell and his performance, and I know you're praising it as much as you possibly can. I get what you're saying about maybe some of the line readings. Is he Frederick March? No, he's not.
Right.
Is he Dana Andrews? No. That doesn't take away anything from this performance, or even how polished I think the performance is. And go back to the airplane where they're coming into town and it's morning and we get that close up. And what Russell does, what Russell and Wyler do in that close-up of him, of Homer, as he looks out at the heavens over the clouds, and the complexity of everything he's feeling in that moment, he transmits all of that. his close-up in that moment is just as good as any close-up we get from Dana Andrews or Frederick March, and I think they're both great in this film.
Agreed. Totally agree. That moment in the plane, you know, I purposely said it's like we're flying over the fruited plain, because I think this is a point to talk about. The thing I talk about with Dodsworth, too, is Wyler's relationship with America as an idea. And there is such an ambivalence about being American, about the country as a whole, about how it treats its returning soldiers. I don't think he's gone to cynicism at this point. I wouldn't say that. This is not like Billy Wilder. You know, we've talked about him in comparison to Billy Wilder, but there's definitely an ambivalence. And you see that with these gorgeous landscape shots in the plane. Homer even says, sure is beautiful. But then we get those notes you mentioned about the golfers, you know, and we see this kind of questioning of, is it as perfect as it looks like from up here? We get Al's speech at the banker's dinner, where he's trying to hide his disgust at capitalism over, you know, he's obviously standing up for fellow veterans who want loans and maybe don't have collateral. This is the gist of the conflict at work, right? And Al wants to give it to him. And the bank is saying, you know, no, it's not. It's risky. And so Al is almost representing this more old-fashioned bootstrap, you know, pull yourself by your bootstrap mentality. And his bosses are just more pure capitalism, right? This is going to be post-war boom, and we're going to take advantage of it, even if it means leaving behind those who helped us win the war.
Yeah, but they'll play the patriotism game when it serves them.
Exactly. And Al is part of that. He's kind of like this token.
I want to tell you all that the reason for my success as a sergeant is due primarily to my previous training in the Corn Belt Loan and Trust Company. The knowledge I acquired in the good old bank, I applied to my problems in the infantry. For instance, one day in Okinawa, a major comes up to me and he says, Stevenson, you see that hill? I said, yes, sir, I see it. All right, he said. You and your platoon will attack said hill and take it. So I said to the major, but that operation involves considerable risk. We haven't sufficient collateral. I'm aware of that, said the major, but the fact remains that there is the hill and you are the guys who are going to take it. So I said to him, I'm sorry, major. No collateral, no hill. So we didn't take the hill and we lost the war. I think that little story has considerable significance. But I've forgotten what it is.
I think this movie is more interested in these individual men's stories. But I think with just this idea of Wyler, again, as coming from Europe and making these American films, of how he's processing that in his movies. Mm-hmm. I don't think this goes as hard as something like Born on the 4th of July in its critique of America or its depiction of, you know, a returning veteran who's facing disability. It doesn't go as hard as that, but I still think this is incredibly bravely honest for 1946.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And here we should probably give some credit to McKinley Cantor, who wrote the book that this was based on, Glory for Me, in 1945. But yeah, this movie's coming out in 46, Josh. And you mentioned Born on the 4th. You could go back a little earlier than that. You know, I looked this up today just to make sure I had the dates right, but Vietnam ends in 75. Coming Home comes out in 78. You get Apocalypse Now being made 79. And being released, then you get those movies of the 80s like Platoon that kind of started, that launched this,
right,
this spike in the Vietnam War film genre. Looking back now with some distance on America's involvement in Vietnam, and the entire time I was watching this film, I just kept shaking my head thinking, how can it be 1946? How can the war just have ended? And how can this movie be, I think I've used this word at least once, I'll use it again, how can it be this sophisticated?
Yeah.
How can it be this sensitive and insightful without the benefit of that time? And I did read something today, Josh, that said Wyler had been honorably discharged from the military. McKinley Cantor himself was in the war. So these guys knew.
Yeah.
They had to have. You watch the film and you get that sense. I didn't know watching it that he had a military background, but you understand that this doesn't feel like just a director for hire kind of picture. This is something Wyler seems to intuitively understand, and it does capture all of the things you're talking about. For me, what really stood out, Josh, was the way, not just how Al or his military record is used, but in the case of all three men, whether they want this to be true or not. They're proud of their service, but it's not like they want it to define them. It's not them who continue to define themselves that way. It's everyone around them. It's everyone around them who doesn't let them forget. And so you've got someone like Al, who it turns out is going to get this cushy VP job. And it's really just because they want to be able to say, we have a vice president,
right,
who's decorated, who's a decorated military man. And the line they give him about, well, who understands these men better than you do, when he exhibits that he really does understand them, they get angry.
Yes.
And they want to punish him for it. Fred is someone who they say, well, just because you're a military guy doesn't mean you're going to get your old job back. And they're constantly bringing it up. For better or worse, it's society that won't define them in any other way and either uses it against them or uses it in ways to benefit them, but not the servicemen.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And the fact that it stays so personal while also representing, you know, each of these men are representing how many? Thousands, a million out there who mm-hmm. are going through this. And the fact that it's a movie that's willing to question the costs this soon after the war, I have to imagine, you know, that's why it's so shocking to me, just having been taught and learned about. And my grandfather was in the Navy in World War II, and he didn't talk about it much, but it was always communicated more around him than what he communicated, to your point you just made, how wonderful it was that he was in the service, right? It was just kind of always something that others sort of like held around him like banners, and he himself never really talked about. And that was always curious to me. And then you see something like The Best Years of Our Lives, and it kind of clicks, right? And what you were just describing about how they don't want it to define them mm-hmm. explains a lot of that. And to think that a movie is willing to explore that this soon after the war, when it had to have been, I would imagine, like everyone wanted focusing on the boom and the victory and the honor and the glory and whatever truth there might be in some of those elements. Mm-hmm. Here's a movie that's also wanting to say, yes, but, and that had to be radical. I imagine it had to be radical, but maybe not if it went on to have maybe this much Oscar success, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to know. And part of that too, I was really struck by, there's multiple references to it, but there's one early on that's really kind of startling. You think about the indignity of these men coming home, being defined by their service, seemingly people wanting to exploit them for that. They've suffered, or they're walking into situations with a lot of trepidation. And then you get people saying casual things like, well, the next time we go to war, we'll all just be blown to bits with the push of a button.
How about that?
How about that? The fatalism of this film, the acknowledgement of the specter of now post-World War II, the atomic bomb, what war means now. And that's all fine. That's powerful enough in and of itself, Josh. But then think about it in terms of what the movie does, is it makes us think about that in terms of these characters who have lost so much, who have sacrificed so much, who did all this. And when they come back, not only do people really not seem to care that much about their sacrifice, they're faced with things like, well, you're the last ones that will ever even have to go through this. That's what the thought was at the time anyway, because now war will never be like that again. And we're all probably just going to die anyway. So why did you waste your time?
That's what Butch says, right? Played by Hoagy Carmichael. I think he's the one who makes that comment. The next war is his phrase. We'll all just mm-hmm. get blown up. That was shocking to me too. You know, again, yeah. I'm experiencing history very much through the lens of movies, which maybe isn't the wisest thing, but I always think about, you know, the 50s are when nuclear anxiety became a real thing. There are a few moments of nuclear anxiety in this picture. That's the one. Butch saying that about the next war. How about Al's son? Immediately the first night he gets back, saying, you were in Hiroshima, right? Did you see any victims? Did they, like, he wants to know if they mm-hmm. looked like burnt or something like that. Like, he knows the horrors and he's asking about it. And he's talking all about how they're learning about atomic energy. And you realize that, again, the perception is that the U.S. helped win World War II and everyone just had a party for the next 10 years. And it's like, no, people realized what this meant, how that war was mm-hmm. won, the yeah. devastating effects of that, And what that meant for the entire globe was something that caused deep anxiety. And here again, is a movie willing to talk about that?
Yeah. The scene we mentioned with Wilma and Homer at bedtime, that is reflective of something Wyler is maybe just the best at. I'm going to proclaim that after seeing two films in this marathon, and I think six of his films overall. I'm going to describe it as the business of scenes. Giving characters something to do while they're doing something else that reveals something about them and or advances the story. And I say that scene with Wilma and Homer is reflective, but not an example, because that scene is very much about the intimacy of her helping him and putting her hands on him and his clothing, what his hooks are doing, what her hands are doing. That brings me back to Butch and the business of scenes. It's hands that we get when Homer, here very early in this first scene where they all reunite at the bar, makes his big speech. He talks about what he wants from his family and how he wants to be treated. And you've got Hoagy Carmichael playing the piano.
Yeah.
The dexterity of his fingers, a counterpoint, a very deliberate one, a counterpoint to Homer and everything he's saying. And yet it's a moving scene, Josh, not just because of what Russell is saying and how he's delivering it, but because by playing the piano and not being self-conscious about playing the piano, Butch is exhibiting exactly what Homer wishes his family would do.
Mm-hmm.
He's not acting aware. He's yes. not treating him differently. He knows that he's talking about hands while his hands are showing off. And yet he keeps playing. He keeps going. And then here it is, that deep focus. The deep focus in that scene of them in the foreground, but the other characters and what's happening in the bar, life continuing to go on around them, even as they're having this moment and this character is making this very vulnerable speech. Wyler is always keeping that in the context of life swirling around them. And there's other examples. There's so many other examples. How about the work of getting the drunk Al to bed that Myrna Loy mm-hmm. has to do as yeah. as Millie, the business of him humming and rocking, and how did they coordinate that? The actual choreography of that, despite the fact that he's seated upright, sitting in bed the whole time, but she's trying to get, actually, I can't believe I'd ever made the connection before, a pajama scene.
True.
It's a pajama yep. scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she gets him into his pajamas, but that swaying back and forth that the drunk man is doing, again, could have been rote, could have been a scene where we spy them for a few minutes as she helps him get undressed or takes his shoes off and throws him into bed. Wyler gives them business to do that makes us understand how familiar they are with each other.
Yeah. Myrna Loy, so good in this, in a role that's, you know, probably in terms of screen time and like further down the list. But man, does she make every moment work as Al's wife. Just she always knows more than she's letting on in a scene, but doesn't insist on it or push mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. And then when she gets a line at one point, Peggy, Teresa Wright, wonderful. Also, everyone's wonderful in this, but Teresa Wright, wonderful. You know, her adult, young adult daughter is saying how you don't understand. You've always had it easy as a couple, you know, and I think she just says, and she says this to Al, not to Peggy, her daughter. She says it to Al. How many times have we had to fall in love all over again? Just kind of telling Peggy mm-hmm. what she needs to hear by saying that to Al. But yeah, I want to go back to your discussion of that scene with Butch and Homer at the piano in Butch's bar and the deep focus, cinematography. Greg Toland here, the cinematographer, and I think Butch's piano bar, whenever I hear someone talk about best years of our lives, that's the set that comes to mind immediately. Hmm. And crucial scenes take place there. But I think it's also because that's where the deep focus is so brilliantly employed that I have an understanding of the richness of that space. There's a lot of booths in Butch's. There's a lot of little cubbies. Mm-hmm. And because of the deep focus, we can always see what's going on everywhere. So it feels alive. It feels full. And there's a later shot that is another mirror. It's another pairing, Adam, to the one you just talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Where Butch
I have it on my
list. The phone call scene. Again, it's Butch and Homer at the piano, but this time Butch has been teaching Homer how to play a few keys with his hooks, and then Butch plays as well, and so they have a little duet going, and they're showing Al this. Homer is basically saying, Al, look what I've learned. And so the three of them are in the foreground, and Al is distracted because he's just had an argument with Fred. And what happens is the conversation is among the three of them. The action, the piano playing, the business, to your point, is with the three of them. But the deep focus allows us to see at the back of Butch's in a phone booth, Fred is making a very crucial, and I'm dancing around it just in case no one's seen it and they're going to after this. But he's making a very crucial phone call. We know it's crucial. So does Al. And we're allowed to be in both spaces at once. It's just one of the most effective uses of deep focus. And it made me realize, we spent some time talking about blocking in Dodsworth and Wyler's use of that. It made me realize that deep focus is kind of like blocking on steroids. It makes every person's position count, no matter how far back they are in a scene. And we get this again later in a wedding scene where...
Beat me to it.
Okay, go ahead. No, you, you take the baton.
That was a perfect handoff of the baton to where I wanted to go, because here again, thank you, William Wyler. Thank you, Greg Tolan. The wedding scene where we now have these men, these couples, all reunited after everything we've seen them go through. You've got these three characters now in different stages of their lives and in different places with their relationships. And that camera, Tolan's camera, between the cutting that we get and the use of deep focus, either shots that showcase all three men together or shots that maybe focus on Homer, but we see one of the other men in the background and we cut between them, but it unifies them in this space. But it does so much more than that too, Josh, where we're always aware of those different stages. We're aware that this is Homer and Wilma, hopefully embarking on that journey together, a happy one, an intimate one, one in which they share things with each other. At the same time where here, great use of focus, we get Fred, and we also get to see Peggy in the shot and what that may mean for their future. But then we're always looking as well at Al and Millie. And the thing about Al and Millie is, you know that they may have the longest road ahead of them of any of these three couples. That where they're at in their relationship, where he's at because of his drinking.
Yeah, that's true.
The way that Millie at this point seems to be lovingly, but more than anything, kind of putting up with him. It so neatly and visually suggests all of this. We understand all the dynamics of their relationship and their relationship to each other.
Yeah. That now my mind is spinning. You know, you're hopeful at the end of this film, I think, for all three couples, but you've got me thinking, you know, who's got the hardest road ahead of them?
I think it's them. I do.
It might be, you know, and I think this is to the movie's credit, is that it's not tidy at the end.
No.
I don't think that would be honest to everything that it showed us before. Each of these couples have a fraught future in different ways. And so, you know, there's a bit of a grimace to the the smile you have on your face still. You're hoping for them, but it's the very thing that this movie is not doing. This movie is not going to put a shiny, happy face on American involvement in World War II. It's just not going to do that. And so it's not also going to do the same for each of these individual marriages that has been really like thrown over by that conflict in a way that wouldn't have been before.
Is there anything else on your list? I mean, I have more notes, but maybe we stop here. I already envision that 10 years from now, we're going to revisit this film again.
Yeah, let's save some stuff. I don't think either of us feels like we've exhausted We've exhausted it at all, and we do have awards. And I don't know. I mean, hopefully we've convinced anyone who's been hesitant. It's almost 3 hours, right? And if it sounds like, I don't know, like, and maybe this sounds good to people, like a post-war staid melodrama about soldiers returning home, it's so much richer than that might suggest.
Yeah. And I'm going to echo what you said. I'll restate it here just to make sure people understand, because I went into it maybe feeling a little bit this way. I'm like, oh, this is going to be really serious and heavy, and it's 3 hours long, and I've got a lot of things to do. And as much as I'm eager to see this film, can I really can I really commit the time and energy to it? Or do I just have to kind of get through it? And Josh, I sat down on a Saturday morning and I didn't look away from it for the next 3 hours. It is all the things we're saying, but it's also a thrilling movie in a lot of ways. And for its seriousness and its somberness, it certainly should not be a movie that anyone is hesitant or scared to watch.
And there are light little touches too. Real quickly, one example is when Millie and Peggy, mother and daughter, this is the first night they've chaperoned these three men who have reunited and gotten drunk. They're putting them to bed, or at least a couple of them to bed, and they just share a laugh together. This is one of those this is one of those grace notes. Totally it not is. Necessary for the plot. But after the men have been put to bed, mother and daughter look at each other like, what the hell just happened to us tonight?
Familiarity.
That was ridiculous. Human. And they giggle and then they go to bed. And so there are moments of lightness in this as well.
There are. The Best Years of Our Lives is currently streaming on Prime Video and available VOD or interlibrary loan. In 2 weeks' time, we'll get back to our Wyler Marathon. We have more important things to do. We got to take a trip to Jasper, Missouri. We got to go to the Double Deuce.
Priorities.
Order a drink or two. Josh, you can have black coffee like Dalton. You'll learn that about him. He's sober. We will get eventually to 1942's Mrs. Miniver, Ben-Hur, after that one. Josh, that's our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, Adam is at Film Spotting, and I'm at Larson on Film. Film Spotting Madness Best of the 1950s voting is live. To vote in the Elite Eight round, go to filmspotting.net or filmspotting.net/madness. For show t-shirts or other merch, go to filmspotting.net/shop. Film Spotting is listener supported. You can join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to the show early and ad free. You'll also get a weekly newsletter, monthly bonus shows, and access to the entire Film Spotting archive.
In that archive, you might want to look up our top five Kristen Stewart scenes. That was way back on episode 627. And we didn't give a full review, unfortunately, to Rose Glass's 2021 feature debut, St. Maud, but it was a Golden Brick nominee, came up on episode 813. And then later that year, as part of our Golden Brick nominees show, reminds me real quick, speaking of movies that have incredible performances across the board, we praised a lot of people in Love Lies Bleeding. I really love Dave Franco too. I don't think we called him out.
I did not realize it was him. I did not recognize him.
He's so good. Yeah. Filmspottingfamily.com. I don't know how many Dave Franco reviews we have in the archive. We'll have to look that up. In limited release, Josh, you can see your beloved The Boy and the Heron, your number one film of last year.
I might have to do that. I might have to catch it a third time. Hey, allow me to plug, though, this reminds me, a video essay I made on Miyazaki for the day job over at Think Christian. I did What Miyazaki and Christianity Have in Common, and give some attention to, a little bit of attention to The Boy and the Heron there, but obviously mostly to previous movies like Princess Mononoke and Ponyo. And yeah, I had a lot of fun making this one, perhaps too much fun. YouTube banned it, even though it's totally fair use. So I'm afraid, you know, you'll have to go to thinkchristian.net to see that one. We'll maybe link to it in the show notes.
Okay, we will link to it indeed in the show notes. Late Night with the Devil, also out in limited release. I've been excited, or curious certainly, to see this one since the Chicago International Film Festival last October. Got a lot of good buzz. David Dasmalchian is a 70s era late night talk show host who accidentally unleashes evil into the nation's living rooms. Our friend Brian Tallarico writes, some questionable choices, but I do love how much it commits to its bit. Riddle of Fire is also out. This is a neo fairy tale film from director Weston Rizzulli about three mischievous children who embark on an odyssey when their mother asks them to run an errand. In wide release, you can see Ghostbusters Frozen Empire or Immaculate, that stars Sydney Sweeney as a young nun who joins an illustrious Italian convent only to discover that it harbors dark and horrifying secrets. They always do. Streaming, you can see Shirley, a biopic about Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman elected to Congress. That stars Regina King. It's directed by John Ridley. And yes, Roadhouse with Jake Gyllenhaal, out now, Prime Video. We're going to watch that. We're going to talk about it. And I'm making Josh watch Clockwork Orange style 1989's Roadhouse starring Patrick Swayze.
I'm sure that will only enhance my enjoyment.
Yeah.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Veronica Phillips. Special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.